sex by date three rule was common, but the pandemic created a new rule book. Any company was good company. Any date was a gift. Maybe it would be good for all of us to keep limiting our options, holding one another accountable, and paying more attention to the moral weight of our decisions. After we had eaten, Benjamin and I said goodbye on a sidewalk as the moon rose. "Well," he began hesitantly, hands rising and falling at his sides. I knew he had ditched the social distancing rules the second I snapped my fingers, and it was nice to have that power. "Let's do this again," I said, and I began walking back to my place when he called to me. His eyes had a twinkle. "You want to FaceTime me when you get back?" he asked. Perhaps this was the new, "Want to come upstairs?" An invitation to take our evening to the next level. "Not a chance," I said, blowing him a kiss. But that was a good try.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
It had to be you. It had to be you. Wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 7 and snowy. Tonight, snowy with a low in the low single digits. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low teens. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a low in the upper single digits. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas. It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy. Welcome to our program. I'm KC Job, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. And our first article will be from our brand new February issue. We'll open with The State. This is Style and Design, Made in Texas by Christian Berno. This month's column entitled Blanket Statement. The maker is Rebecca Wright, calls herself Psychic Outlaw. Location is in Austin. Rebecca Wright, 30-year-old self-taught seamstress, gives vintage textiles a new purpose by creating custom jackets from quilts. Customers can supply their own quilts or pick from a selection culled by Wright, who founded Psychic Outlaw in 2019. Her team of about a dozen sewers and artists, sewists she calls them, also fashions dresses out of bandanas and works with almost any size. Fans of this upcycled unisex look include producer and musician Benny Blanco, who recently wore bespoke quilted overalls while performing with Justin Bieber. "I just wanted to create something that is really classic that stays relevant," Wright says of her brand. Still in The State, this is The Culture, It's Arts by Doyen Oyeneyi. It's entitled this month, Hometown Glory. Austin-based artist Deborah Roberts' evocative collaged images of black children have been shown in London and New York. Now she's finally getting an exhibition in the city where she was born and raised. When Deborah Roberts is about to start a new collage, she looks for a black child's face that possesses a certain purity. "It has to be a face that reminds me of someone who has not been touched by pop culture," the Austin-based artist explains. "That's the innocent person I want you to find in the multiplicity of faces." Once she's found her base face, usually by searching online through images of young people from the Caribbean, most often Haiti and various African countries, she'll collage the hell out of it, manipulating the source image and then layering facial features borrowed from other photographs on top. Everything else, such as the child's body, clothing, and accessories, is secondary. When she started creating collages a decade ago, Roberts, who is now 58, focused on the experiences of black girls who had reached the age when they begin absorbing conflicting ideas about beauty, self, and the adults they'll eventually become. This time of self-actualization is particularly tricky for black girls who must grapple with negative messages about their blackness, about hair that isn't straight enough, skin that isn't light enough, features that aren't European enough. In addition to bearing the weight of racist beauty standards, black girls are burdened by adultification, a term used by researchers to describe how they are often seen as older and less innocent than their white counterparts. In nearly all of Robert's collages, at least one child is looking directly at the viewer, as if challenging us to remember that black children are children. Consider her 2018 mixed media piece, Red, White, and Blue, a 70 by 62 inch work on white canvas. Two black girls in Converse shoes, each clutching a red boxing glove, stand back to back. Their clothes are a jumble of bright colors and patterns, a nod to the stylistic freedom of children. One of the girls, wearing a hijab, is rendered in profile. The other gazes directly at the viewer, an effect made even more jarring because Roberts has covered one of her eyes with an eye from a different person. While the subject's faces and hands are collaged, their bodies and most of their clothes are painted and drawn, which further calls our attention to their resolute expressions. Their shared stance declares that it's them against the world. It's clear that the figure on the right, who looks out of the canvas, is ready to fight, even if that means fighting the viewer. There's also that reminder in her eyes. She shouldn't have to battle anyone or anything. She shouldn't need a boxing glove. Roberts, who was born in East Austin in the early 60s, has considered herself an artist since she was 8 years old. Her mother, a housekeeper, and her father, an electrical lineman, were good parents, but they didn't quite understand her determination to pursue art professionally. To them, art was a hobby, not a career. To Roberts, it's always represented something bigger. Art has been at the center of my existence as a way of getting me through bad, unhappy times, she says. I can do art and go into a place for hours and exist there. One of those unhappy times was in the sixth grade when, as part of the city's half-hearted attempt to integrate, she was bused to Travis Heights Elementary School just west of I-35. She was one of the only black students in her school, and a white teacher, she says, was hostile towards her. I had never been treated this way because I'd gone to a school where a teacher loved us and disciplined us and treated us equally, she says. Roberts turned to art, drawing portraits of her celebrity crushes, Elle DeBarge and Michael Jackson. Her dedication to her craft eventually led her to Denton, where she earned a bachelor's degree in fine arts from the University of North Texas. After graduating, Roberts returned to Austin and established a free summer art workshop for teens called Success Comes in Cans, Not Cants, which lasted for 8 years. In 1889, she opened the Not Just Art Gallery in Westlake Hills, a wealthy, largely white part of West Austin where she hoped to put her work and that of other artists in front of audiences who wouldn't normally see it. At the time, Roberts was focused on figurative, detailed, Norman Rockwell-esque drawings of black life, and she managed to sell a fair number of them. But running a gallery was an expensive proposition, and she struggled to get the numbers to add up. Drowning in debt, she closed it after about 10 years. Over the ensuing decades, Roberts occasionally found herself living the stereotypical life of a starving artist, taking odd jobs such as baking at Safeway and selling shoes at Academy while she continued painting in her spare time. She never had a plan B. I told somebody about 4 years ago that I was all in, that this was me to the end, Roberts says, laughing. Ride or die. Thank God things turned around. In the early 2010s, more than a quarter century after she had last attended school, Roberts enrolled in the Master of Fine Arts program at Syracuse University in upstate New York. Among other goals, she hoped to ground her art more firmly in the literature of black writers such as Cornel West, whom she had begun reading intensively. While at Syracuse, she decided to try a creative exercise that Franklin Sermons, then a curator at the Manil Collection in Houston, had once suggested to her. Make 20 works of art from one concept. The idea was to allow herself to work through everything she was thinking, to leave no options unexplored, however half-baked or unrealized. And a little sidebar here, Art Car. Roberts had fans of her art as early as the third grade when she traded pictures she'd drawn of racing cars with her classmates for an assortment of color pencils. Back to our text. One of her professors scoffed at the arbitrary nature of the practice. Well, why 20? Roberts remembers her teacher asking. Why not 100? Why not 200? Oh, you think I can't do 200? She responded. Rising to the challenge, Roberts bought four thick 12 by 12 inch sketchbooks and began exercising my brain, as she puts it. In the end, Roberts overshot her goal, creating 225 works. Some of her first collages emerged from this period, including many of the pieces in her Little Debbie series, which were made out of pictures of Roberts as a child. The exercise resulted in some hits and some misses. I could look at some of them today and say, oh my God, ew, Roberts said. I know they were bad, but it's just like any type of muscle or exercise. You have to do it multiple times until you start to get that rhythm. The 3 years she spent in Syracuse allowed her to achieve the sort of breakthrough for which she had been reaching. She transitioned away from her Rockwell-style drawings and focused on her collages of black girls. And, not quite overnight, the shift paid off. In 2017, Roberts presented her new collages at the Volta Art Fair in New York, an international event focused on both emerging and established artists. There, her work captivated buyers and critics from around the world. Word started getting around. The following year, she held her first solo museum exhibition, Deborah Roberts, The Evolution of Mimi, at the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art in Atlanta. In 2018, she was invited to the month-long Fountainhead Residency in Miami, and in 2019, she participated in the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation Residency. For years, Roberts had created art in her small one-bedroom apartment, but by 2018, she was making enough money that she was finally able to afford her own studio space at Canopy Austin, a collection of studios and galleries. And this past March, she moved into a brand new house. Since Roberts' success at the Volta Art Fair, her work has been exhibited at the Studio Museum of Harlem, National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., and London's prestigious Stephen Friedman Gallery, among others. Beyoncé, Ava DuVernay, Padma Lakshmi are just a few of her celebrity fans, but she'd never had a solo museum show in Texas, an omission that has finally been rectified. On January 23rd, Deborah Roberts, I'm, opens at the Contemporary Austin. It will run through August 15th. The exhibition features about two dozen works, including the collages for which she's best known, as well as text-based pieces screen-printed on 30 by 22-inch paper. One such picture piece is We Are Greater Than or Equal to They, in which those titular words stand alone against the white background, leaving it up to the viewers to work out whether the we and they refer to gender, race, nationality, or some other fiercely contested form of identity. Another component of the exhibition, an interactive booth that Roberts describes as a space that feels like being in the black body, is similarly dependent on the perspective of the viewer. The installation is a reappropriation of a Catholic confessional in which viewers find a mirror rather than a priest. The piece forces participants to confront their own reactions to audio and video generated by Roberts, some of which includes racist content. I never know what you get to think about it, Roberts says. It's between you and yourself. A standout element of the exhibition is Little Man, Little Man, a mural on the southern wall of Contemporary's exterior, facing pedestrians and eastbound traffic on 7th Street. The facade features six collages of a young black boy, which represents an expansion from her focus on black girls that occurred a few years ago after a number of black men told her they felt her art was lacking their perspectives. One of the most powerful works she has made since then is a series of collages titled Nessun Dorma, about George Stinney Jr., a 14-year-old black boy from South Carolina who was executed in 1944 after he was convicted of murdering two white girls. His conviction was overturned in 2014. But the piece on the Contemporary's exterior is of a completely different register. This unnamed boy's flailing limbs appear as though he's performing popular black dance moves such as the Woa and the Nene. He looks exuberant and free, an embodiment of the social media phrase hashtag Black Boy Joy, which seeks to reclaim the rapture of childhood for black men and boys who are often denied the innocence of youth. It's a poignant piece, especially if you glance upward to take in the iridescent textual sculpture by New York-based artist Jim Hodges, installed along the south and east edges of the museum's roof in 2016. It reads, "With Liberty and Justice for All." Of course, Roberts' collages of black girls remain a core of the exhibition, but even those reflect changes in her work. One major stylistic deviation is the use of black backgrounds in some of the collages. Roberts has typically set her pieces against white or faintly hued backdrops, bringing to mind the words of the writer and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston, "I feel most colored when I am thrown against a sharp white background." But in portraits, When They Look Back, number 3, two black girls lightly outlined in shaded arms and dresses blend in with the black canvas, suggesting a more welcoming space for them. This fall, I'm, will travel to the Museum of Contemporary Art, Denver, and Roberts is already preparing for another solo exhibition at Vielmetter, Los Angeles, in September. She regards her Austin exhibit as an important milestone. After 5 decades, it's a chance to finally show her hometown what she can do. "I've been here, and you just didn't see me," Roberts said. "I've been here." Next, we're turning to one of our feature articles. This one's entitled Not Her Last Rodeo. It's by Laura Bile. Not even close. After a half century of winning trophies and training champions, barrel racing's queen of sequins, Martha Josey, still rides. The race at Rodeo Austin should have been just one more rung on Martha Josey's climb through barrel racing history. She was already rodeo royalty. A former world champion and National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame inductee, and on this dry, pleasant March evening in 2004, she hoped to qualify for the National Barrel Racing Finals for a fifth consecutive decade. Her boots jammed into the stirrups, Josey waited in the alleyway connecting the main arena to the parking lot. The muffled cheers of spectators wafted from the bleachers above. She was seconds from her first run. The competitor with the fastest total time after three rounds would win. With her hat pulled low and red lipstick bright enough to see from the rafters, she felt the rhythmic breathing of her horse, Red Man Bay, a gelding with an odd fondness for Dr. Pepper. As soon as she heard her name over the loudspeaker, Josey leaned forward, a signal to Red Man Bay that their moment had come. Barrel racing is the only pro rodeo event in which riders enter the arena at a full run. Red Man Bay began to walk, then shifted from trot to gallop to sprint. They burst into the bright lights and looped around each of the three barrels, Josie's dark hair flying. In 15.58 seconds, a tie for the fastest run so far that night, it was over. Her horse raced back into the dimness beneath the stands. They continued down the alley toward a concrete breezeway where a gate stood open. Then, just as she reached it, someone swung the gate closed, not knowing a horse and rider were strides away from the threshold. Panicked and unable to stop, Red Man Bay attempted a jump, but his chest slammed into the steel bars. Josey was catapulted like a rag doll over the top and thrown face down onto the pavement on the other side. An emergency medical crew arrived within minutes and found Josey unconscious, with blood oozing from her nose, ears, and scalp. Paramedics cut an incision into her side to release the fluid pooling around a collapsed lung, then loaded her into an ambulance headed for Brackenridge Hospital. Veterinarians sought Red Man Bay. Josie's close friend, Deb Brown, who'd been at the arena, rushed to the hospital and found Josey on a gurney in a treatment bay, unmoving, as doctors frantically tried to stabilize her fading heartbeat. Her husband, R.E. Josey, told Brown he wouldn't go near her because he couldn't bear to watch his wife die. Brown, a cop and former paramedic, recognized in Josey the sunken, ashen look of a human body losing its grip on life. She clasped Josie's hand and gently encouraged her friend to hold on, fearing her wounded lungs would soon be spent. At some point, Josey heard Brown's voice. Without opening her eyes, Josey gradually regained consciousness. In a faint murmur, she asked where she was. She asked about her horse. And then, blood still caked in her hair, she asked, "Deb, am I winning the barrel race?" In rodeo, known for crowd-pleasing feats of endurance and brute strength, barrel racing is an anomaly. A quarter minute of grace and speed, a 1,000-pound animal on candlestick legs, weaving a tight cloverleaf pattern around three 55-gallon drums spaced out in a triangle. This is where cowgirls are made. Although Annie Oakley made history as Western Riding's first female superstar, captivating audiences with her sharpshooting and Buffalo Bills variety shows in the late 1800s, women became largely shut out as rodeo developed into an organized sport throughout the first half of the 20th century. Then, in 1948, a group of women, mostly wives and daughters of farmers and ranchers, met in San Angelo and formed what they called the Girls Rodeo Association, with barrel racing as its premier event. In those days, barrel racers were equal parts decoration and athlete. Their duties weren't just to compete, but also to carry various state and national flags during open ceremony rites at rodeo events. It was all about, as Josey recalled, fast horses and pretty women. Today, after decades of fights to assure fair pay, prize money for barrel racing is equal to that for bull riding and other male-dominated events. In 1981, the Girls Rodeo Association became Women's Professional Rodeo Association. It remains the oldest women's professional sports organization in the country, boasting $7 million in annual payouts. A proven barrel racing horse can fetch as much as a new Ford F-350. Sports tend to reward the young, with most athletes peaking in their 20s and 30s before their bodies age out. Charmaine James, the most decorated barrel racer in history, won her first of 11 world championships at 14 and retired in 2003 when she was 33. Martha Josie turns the sports world's fealty to youth on its head. She was approaching 30 before she even started racing at the elite level. She didn't win a world championship until she was 42, when she last qualified for the national finals of rodeo at 60. 5 years later, she won a race that landed her on a Wheaties box. Competitors earn their spots in the NFR, the National Super Bowl of Rodeo, by ranking among the top 15 money winners in their event over the course of the season. Josie made the NFR in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Nolan Ryan's 27th season in the Major League are a remarkable achievement, but Josie's longevity ranks her among the longest competing professional athletes in American sports history. Imagine Serena Williams qualifying for the U.S. Open in 2045 and then making the round of 16 finalists. Josie was 66 on the night she crashed to the ground in Austin. Her pelvis was shattered, her skull and six ribs were fractured, and still she had no intention of giving up. When she was a teenager, the only sport Martha Arthur, Josie's maiden name, knew was basketball. She grew up in Northeast Texas, where her father raised and sold quarter horses, named for their speed over a quarter mile. As a young girl, she rode before she could stand, tucked into the front of her dad's saddle like a cowboy baby born. When she was 10, her father died of a heart attack, and her mother sold all of their horses except a stallion named Jimbo so that Josie and her brother would still have one horse to ride. The family moved in with Josie's paternal grandmother, a nightclub and dance hall owner who lived in a sprawling two-bedroom brick house on more than 200 acres of piney woods between Marshall and Karnak. During her sophomore year at Karnak High School, Josie, who would go on to become homecoming queen, tried out for the basketball team. The first day that I went out for the coach to play basketball, she said, "Do you like to win?" Josie recalled. I said, "I love winning." She said, "Okay, we're going to practice." Josie would not leave the school each day until she had sunk 100 free throws. "I found out that you could win basketball games by making free throws," she said, "and I became a very, very good basketball player. But coach also taught me that practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect." Shortly before graduating from high school, Josie and her two friends in their poodle skirts and bobby socks piled into a car and drove 45 minutes down US 80 to see a rodeo in Shreveport, Louisiana. From the opening ceremony, she was hooked. The grandeur, the crowds, the patriotic swell of the Star Spangled Banner, she knew right away she'd be a cowgirl. The next day, she took Jimbo out of his stall, set up a barrel in her grandmother's pasture, and began to practice. She hadn't ridden in 8 years. After high school, Josie took a secretarial job at the Longhorn Army Ammunition Plant near the banks of Caddo Lake. On weekends, she would rent a trailer for $5, hitch it to her mother's old two-tone Buick sedan, and haul Jimbo to races. The intense focus required to shoot free throws under pressure had taught her that mental strength often separates great athletes from good ones, that a race can be won or lost in the moments before a horse starts running. Basketball had also left her with the dexterity and coordination to rein in her horse and grab the saddle horn without looking at her hands. To win, a rider must always look where she wants to go. Everything is achieved by feel. Even today, when Josie hosts rodeo clinics, she tells aspiring barrel racers to find a ball and learn to dribble without looking down. Yet she would have likely stayed a moderately good barrel racing hobbyist had she not met a half-thoroughbreed named C.B. Reed in 1960. C.B. was named after his owner, a Longview rancher named C.B. Reynolds, who had known Josie's father. He was trying to sell the horse but couldn't attract an offer that satisfied him. C.B. had some unfortunate habits for a barrel horse. Most notably, he had a one-and-done mindset, wanting to circle only a single barrel before scurrying back to the gate. He also didn't look like a typical barrel racing horse. He used his long, thoroughbred gait to charge full force toward the barrel, then dropped his hindquarters so low that his tail dragged on the ground while he turned and slid around, pulling forward with his front hooves. He held his head high instead of bending it toward a turn, yet somehow he never lost his forward momentum. Reynolds asked Josie if she would ride CB in regional rodeos to show prospective buyers what the horse could do. She borrowed him off and on for 5 months and realized something other would-be owners had not. CB was more athletically gifted than any animal Josie had seen. He never lost his bearings and hardly ever bumped the barrel, even at top speed. Just as important, he had fire in his belly. He wanted to win as much as I did, she told me. Before I went into the ring, he would almost stand and look at the other barrel racers and decide how much he wanted to beat them by. Reynolds wanted $5,000 for Seedy, but he agreed to settle for $2,500. In a tale that is now told and retold in Martha Josie lore, she cried while admitting to her mother that she'd agreed to buy Seedy but didn't have the money. The mother told her she'd just sold a mineral lease on their property for $2,500. Seedy was hers. Josie describes acquiring CB as her Cinderella moment. Only the prince of this fairy tale was a gelding with a narrow blaze and two white stockings on one side. One day I didn't have anything, Josie told me, and the next day I had this horse that was phenomenal. Josie realized that she could correct CB's one barrel problem by placing an irritating piece of leather in his bit just under his cheek to get his attention when he needed to turn toward another barrel. With a ferocity for practice carried over from the basketball court, she would saddle CB every day after coming home from the ammunition plant and ride until dark. After she had trained him, many on the rodeo circuit couldn't even recognize him as the same animal who'd always wanted to call it a night after one barrel. The pair never looked back. By 1964, Josie was a Texas Barrel Racing Association champion. The 1965 story in Quarter Horse Journal noted, the attractive brunette won the coveted crown by a margin of 1,700 points over her closest rival. By her count, she and CB won 52 races in a row. The extraordinary winning streak allowed Josie to exercise another natural skill, showmanship. She hired a seamstress from Karnak to custom tailor her outfits with sparkles and fringe. She once came across an old wedding dress and repurposed it into a lacy, poofy competition shirt. It was maybe overdone in the eyes of her competitors, but just think what that looked like in the arena, said photographer Kenneth Springer, who has covered barrel racing since the 60s. It was glamorous. Over the course of her career, she became known as the Queen of Sequins. Martha has always, always dressed the part no matter where it was, Springer added. It could be the hottest, dirtiest, most dusty arena, and she's gonna dress like a cowgirl. Never one for understatement, Josie soon used a chunk of her rapidly accruing prize money to purchase a new black and white Pontiac Bonneville and a matching custom-made horse trailer with a cherry red interior. One day in 1965, she pulled into the parking lot for a barrel race in Hillsboro near Waco when a young calf roper named R.E. Josie saw her get out and unload CB. He turned and asked a buddy about the brunette with a chiseled gelding. Today, Martha and R.E. joked that he fell in love at first sight with CB. At the time, R.E. had a rope burn across his face, with which Josie took to be a permanent scar. That night when he asked her out, she agreed, partly out of pity. Once they began dating, he was pleased to find out that the mark had faded. They were quickly smitten and married the following year, moving to R.E.'s hometown of Post, near Lubbock, where he worked in oil fields as a driller and a pumper. It wasn't long before he discovered his new wife was not fond of the kitchen. This remains true today. One recent Christmas, R.E. decided to hide Josie's presence in the oven, knowing it had the one door in the house she would never open. As a woman who had grown up beneath East Texas's towering pines, Josie was soon homesick. Plains had too much dust, too much wind, too much unbroken sky. She missed the lacy shade of oaks and evergreens, and she missed her mother, who had inherited her grandmother's land back near Marshall. She talked R.E. into moving in with her mother and opening a rodeo school. He renovated the sagging barn. They fenced off an arena. Some evenings, he would turn on the car headlights so he and Martha could ride horses long into the night. The couple opened Josie Ranch in 1967 with a class of 33 students. They charged $100 for room and board plus 2 weeks of barrel racing and roping instruction. Josie spent most of the first $3,300 to hire a professional photographer to shoot images for brochures and ads. She'd inherited an instinct for promotion from her grandmother, Maddie Castleberry, an inventive marketer at a time when few women owned businesses. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, but she loved being an entertainer, Josie told me. Her grandmother once coaxed a popular church band to play at one of her dance halls, Maddie's Ballroom, on a Saturday night. The religious ensemble, concerned about a secular drift, agreed on the condition that she keep their name off any flyers. Once they had a deal, Maddie drove through the streets of Longview, hanging halfway out of her car with a bullhorn to announce the upcoming gig. Sunday morning, most of the congregation filed into their pews with Maddie's Ballroom ticket stubs still stapled to their collars. Take a little break here, and Natural Spot reminds you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Radio since 1967, and now back to our text. Martha comes across as Southern and a little naive, Springer, the rodeo photographer, observed, but she is one of the best businesswomen ever. She's developed sponsorships with the makers of horse health and nutrition products and ranch equipment, proudly wearing their logos for the cameras as she films product endorsements. A Purina horse feed banner hangs at the entrance to Josie Ranch. She sells her own brand of bits and saddles, attached her name to a now-defunct line of signature Western wear. But most of her success has come from the rodeo school. In the 54 years since it's opened, Josie Ranch has hosted tens of thousands of students. Josie puts the number at more than 200,000. These days, when registration opens for her summer camps, parents wait by the computers like fans trying to snag concert tickets. The kids return year after year, and when they grow up, they enroll their own sons and daughters. Many have gone on to their own rodeo fame, including recent world champions Fallon Taylor and Mary Walker. When Josie won the barrel racing world title in 1980, her closest challenger, Lynn McKenzie, was one of her former students. From the start of her career, Josie was determined to be world champion. When she wasn't at the ranch teaching, she and R.E. were on the road, winning belt buckles, saddles, horse trailers, and trophies. She made it to the National Finals Rodeo while riding CB in 1968 and 1969, but by 1970, he was starting to show his age. She tried other horses, but none could match his ability and drive to scorch the competition. Then one day in March 1978, she and R.E. attended a barrel racing clinic in Hutchinson, Kansas. R.E., who could scout horses like a coach eyeing quarterbacks, mentioned he liked the looks of one woman's bay horse. By the time he told Josie, however, the event had ended and the attendees had returned to their motel rooms. Martha marched up and down the hallways of the motel, knocking on doors, searching unsuccessfully for the owner of the bay. I was actually sitting in my hotel room, she recalled. It was 5 o'clock in the morning and a truck outside starts up. She hurried to the parking lot and in a stroke of luck found the woman she was looking for. With R.E. still in bed, Josie wrote a check for $7,500 on the spot. This gelding's name was Sonny Bit of Both. She began to train him and he took her to the national finals 4 years in a row. The duo won the American Quarter Horse Championship and the World Barrel Racing Championship in 1980, a twin record that's never been matched. Barrel racers typically own one standout horse that makes their careers. Josie owned two champions at the same time and went on to qualify for the national finals on four additional horses over the rest of her career. After Josie began riding Sonny, CB lived the rest of his days at Josie Ranch, free to wander as he pleased like an oversized dog. When he died at age 25, Josie buried him under a tree she can glimpse from her kitchen window. Her fame grew after the World Championship, and so did demand for her coaching. In 1981, while filming an instructional tape about training inexperienced horses, Josie suffered one of the most debilitating injuries of her career. I had borrowed a young horse from a friend, she recalled. He'd been great for the whole film, but then all of a sudden, as young horses can do, he started jumping and lunging and bucking. Josie was thrown off and hit the ground on her side. The impact snapped her pelvis, and when an ambulance arrived to rush her to the hospital in Shreveport, Josie told the EMTs that she couldn't move her legs. They said that I'd never walk again, and I would definitely never ride again, she recalled. They thought I was paralyzed. When Josie first returned home, she needed a wheelchair but was determined to resume her career as soon as her pelvis healed. After all, she was the reigning world champion. She exercised daily in the ranch's swimming pool to regain strength in her legs, while R.E. would lead Sonny into a pond on the property, making him swim to stay in shape, with Josie wheeling along the banks to keep her horse motivated. She is fearless, said longtime friend John Adams, a retired physician in Marshall, who saw her after the accident. A few months later, Josie was back on the rodeo circuit. She and Sonny made the finals again in 1981. This time, her ex-pupil, McKenzie, took the championship. Josie can think of only one time when she ever felt frightened, and her fear had nothing to do with cracked skulls or busted hip bones. During her 1980 pursuit of the world title, she realized she was double booked, registered for two rodeos in one day, one in Oklahoma City and the other 450 miles north in Omaha. R.E. offered to drive a horse to Omaha so that Josie could catch a flight after finishing her race in Oklahoma. He assumed she'd fly commercial. Instead, she called the airport and booked a private twin-engine plane for $2,500. Turbulence rocked a small aircraft throughout the two-hour flight. "I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown," she said. Even though she stepped off the plane shaken, she had stuck with her look-good-to-ride-good philosophy. Rare is the soul who has ever seen Josie without full makeup. Once her feet touched solid ground in Nebraska, she hired a limo for the short ride to the venue. Starting with the World Championship, Josie reached the height of her long career in the 80s. She qualified for four national finals in the decade, was inducted into the National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame in 1985, and received the honor of a lifetime at the 1988 Winter Olympics. Calgary, as the host city, chose to showcase rodeo alongside other exhibitions in that year's Olympic Arts Festival as a nod to southwestern Canada's equestrian heritage. Josie was selected for Team USA's barrel racing squad, and in her trademark style, she sized up the proposed uniform's simple design and decided they need some more pizzazz. She had her tailor in Texas create red, white, and blue satin shirts with puffed-up shoulders as big as pineapples, stars down one arm, stripes down the other. The U.S. barrel racing team defeated Canada for the gold arts medal, and Josie won the bronze in individual competition. Josie made what she expected to be her last trip to the National Finals Rodeo in 1998. By then, she was 60 and content to focus on her riding clinics and students rather than the pursuit of championships. But in 2003, she met Red Man Bay, who's one of the finest competitors she'd seen in years, hardly ever touched a barrel as he drew high-speed clovers in the soil beneath his feet. With Red Man Bay, Josie believed she could earn one more trip to the National Finals 46 years after she and CB first qualified. Then came that night in Austin in 2004, the accident. As she lay in her hospital bed, her pelvis broken for a second time, her friend Deb Brown helped answer calls from all over the world as news spread through the tight-knit rodeo community. Josie's doctors told her she was lucky to be alive and recommended that she take a year or two off. But she was no stranger to dire predictions. Meanwhile, Brown overheard R.E. on the phone telling a friend, "I think she's got a cracked skull and her hip may be broken. She's got some good old bruises and her wrist is pretty bad, but other than that, she's doing pretty good." "I will never forget that as long as I live," Brown said. "That's the Josie way. Never quit." After 3 weeks in the hospital, Josie was scheduled to be discharged, but she still wasn't strong enough to sit up on her own. Her brother and nephew came up with a solution. They picked her up in a motorhome that allowed Josie to lie down as they drove back to the ranch. At home, she slept in a hospital bed for a couple months. R.E. got her out of bed each day and drove her to Marshall to rehabilitate her at the hospital's pool. Before long, she added an hour on the treadmill to her routine. In June, just 3 months after fearing that his wife wouldn't live through the night, R.E. helped Josie climb back onto Red Man Bay. "I felt like I was home," she said. She was well enough to return to competition at the end of that month, and she placed seventh at the barrel race in Colorado's Greeley Stampede. "Started going to every rodeo that I could," Josie recalled, but she also became aware that Red Man Bay had yet to fully recover from his injuries. He'd been through rehab, but she could still feel he was sore. "After a race in Cheyenne, Wyoming a few months later, I realized that trying for the national finals would be too hard on my horse." As the years passed, she competed on different horses here and there, but found that the crash in Austin had robbed something from her. She noticed herself entering fewer and fewer races, and she never attempted to make another national finals. "Growing up in Marshall, I knew of Martha Josie. It was hard not to, since the local paper dutifully covered her career milestones, and every drive to Caddo Lake would take my family past the White Gate to Josie Ranch on Texas Highway 43. In the summer of 2013, some cousins from St. Louis visited, and I took them to the Mesquite Championship Rodeo outside Dallas. Before the barrel race began, I gave them a brief tutorial on the sport, and with a surge of hometown pride, I mentioned that a legendary racer named Martha Josie was from Marshall. I wondered aloud what had become of her, realizing that she must have been well into her 70s by then. After the first few women in line made their runs, the name of the next contestant came over the loudspeaker. It was Martha Josie. Today, her camps and clinics remain as popular as ever. When Josie teaches barrel racing, the bonds she forms with the students and their families fulfill her now in the way world championships once did. The honors are still adding up. In 2020, she was named to the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame, a pinnacle of recognition unavailable to women before 2017, but her greatest pride comes from shaping the winners of tomorrow. When I visited Josie Ranch for a recent weekend session, she told me she can spot the girls who will succeed. Talent and ability aren't the only signs of a future winner. Desire is the key. To be a champion, you've got to think like a champion, she said. You've got to act like a champion. And the young girls who flock to Josie's classes continue to idolize her. It's actually kind of scary meeting a legend, said 11-year-old Madison Mansell, whose mother came to Josie Ranch in her youth. 12-year-old Bergen Yazzie told me she felt butterflies in her stomach when she first met Josie. Now that Yazzie has attended 13 camps, though, she's managed to absorb some of her teacher's inextinguishable confidence. Once you come here, she said, you cannot stop coming back. By the end of this weekend, Yazzie had beaten the competition to win a new Martha Josie Circle Y saddle. Josie also presented the shyly smiling student with one of her old competition shirts, a green and gold number with long fringe and natural sequins. Josie turns 83 in March, and she still rides every day. The thought of retirement has never crossed her mind. She's never quit in her life, Mansell said. She's the star that will never go away. This article was by Cedar Hill journalist Laura Bile, a former Dallas Morning News medical reporter. She's written for numerous publications, including Men's Health, New York Times, and Cosmopolitan. She wrote about the stem cell industry for Texas Monthly's January 2020 issue. Next, we're turning to another story in state. This is the culture and its arts, but it's from back in November. We missed this last time, so we'll get it now. It's entitled The Age of Quinn Mason, why a 24-year-old composer from Dallas may be classical music's next superstar. 13 years ago, a class of fifth graders filed into the library of Onesimo Hernandez Elementary School in Dallas for a short career day presentation, a tradition that inspires often unpredictable reactions in the under 12 set. As the students settled into their seats, the Dallas Opera Orchestra's principal oboist, Rogene Russell, smiled at the squirming audience and began to play her instrument. Straight away, an 11-year-old boy blurted out the name of the work as naturally as if it were basic arithmetic. Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, he said. Russell was surprised that a youngster recognized the piece. She did this sort of thing in schools across the city, and she'd never seen a kid with such familiarity. For the remainder of the performance, the boy announced each piece as she played. Prokofiev, he declared, Peter and the Wolf, and so on. After the presentation was over, a counselor introduced Russell to the perceptive student. His name was Quinn Mason, and she was informed he had been listening rather closely to local classical music stations. Though he didn't mention it to her at the time, Mason wasn't just listening to classical music, he was playing and composing it too. He'd started learning piano earlier that year at school, and soon he was checking out books on musical notation from the school library that helped him learn how to set down on paper the sounds in his head. By age 12, he'd written one of his first pieces for solo cello. By age 14, he drafted his first work for a chamber ensemble. By age 18, his first symphony. By 19, he'd won his first composition contest and witnessed the first professional performance of his work. Today, at 24, Mason is one of the most sought-after young composers in the country. He counts 8 commissions on his desk, including a new work, Reflection on a Memorial, which the Dallas Symphony Orchestra is set to premiere November 11th. This level of success for a composer in his early 20s is unusual. Typically, a young composer's work is limited to a conservatory context and not performed for mainstream audiences. Yet for years, Mason's work has captivated listeners and peers, people such as Will White, the musical director and principal conductor of Orchestra Seattle. He engineers his climaxes masterfully. He knows how to structure his forms so that each phrase is calculated to propel the music onward, White says. Most composers, and here I mean even the greats, are fantastic at writing long crescendos that build excitement, but once they've built a head of steam, they don't know what to do with it. Quinn's build-ups always arrive with a bit of payoff. If this wasn't promising enough, consider the buoyant optimism of Houston-born composer-conductor John Axelrod, a mentor of Masons. 200 years from now, he says, people are going to look back at the 21st century and say, this is the age of the composer-conductor Quinn Mason. Quinn Mason has spent most of the past year quarantined in an apartment near Dallas's upscale Oaklawn neighborhood with his mother, Gloria, who works as an overnight shift manager at CVS. Some days he gets up around 10 in the morning, answers email for an hour, then composes until 2 the following morning. Other days he'll wake up in the afternoon and work through the night. He'll often reference a little black moleskin notebook where he keeps his musical ideas, a sketch for a score, a title with an outline. Then he'll use Sibelius, a musical notation software program to flesh out the bars, and a virtual orchestra software program to listen to demos. When Mason and I spoke over Zoom in July, our conversation quickly turned to Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, a groundbreaking century-old magnum opus that has absorbed much of Mason's attention for the past few years. It's my favorite piece, he told me. I literally have 708 recordings of it. On his website, he burrows deeply into his obsession with the work. At any given time in the score, there are multiple rhythms, keys, bitonality, even tempi happening at the same time, he wrote. It's almost strange to remember that this music was written to be danced to. As part of his quest to fully immerse himself in the Rite of Spring, Mason has scrutinized the way various orchestras have approached it. For the New York Philharmonic alone, he's dissected how the group performed it in 1940, 1951, 1958, 1978, 1990, 2007, and 2012. But the London Symphony Orchestra's obscure 1978 recording by the conductor Eduardo Mata is his favorite, he says, because it captures the primitive and brutal spirit of the composition while also keeping it danceable and not pushing it too hard. And he didn't just collect 708 versions of his favorite orchestral composition and commit it to memory. 2 years ago, he assembled 103 versions of a brief 11-beat percussion sequence in the work, strung them together in chronological order by performance, date, and posted the 10-minute compilation, 1133 Rite of Spring Beats, on YouTube. After the link went viral, well, for a classical post, he created a follow-up video, 1133 more Rite of Spring Beats. Conductor Lauren Mazel, 1978, sounds like a broken Macintosh computer startup chime, wrote one follower in the comments. This sort of intense focus is nothing new to Mason. He showed a desire for deep study even in elementary school when he was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a now defunct diagnosis on the autism spectrum that was associated with developing and cultivating a set of special interests. You've seen me on this call, he said during our Zoom chat. You've seen me look everywhere. I definitely get easily distracted. But whenever I'm super focused on something, I won't stop focusing on it. I focus on it for hours and hours. As a toddler, Mason was attracted to musical toys more than to trucks and action figures, so Gloria got him a miniature keyboard. After he started elementary school, she noticed that his infatuation with music was getting in the way of his studies. I don't think I ever did my homework, he says. But while some mothers might have lectured their child about priorities, Gloria had a different philosophy. When a person is in love with something, you can't just be like, hey, put it down and let's focus on this, she says. It doesn't work. Music is his love. She preferred to let him indulge his interests. So indulge he did. Mason learned to play piano, cello, and percussion, and he designed personal challenges for himself, like memorizing Ludwig van Beethoven's symphonies and reading all the music books in his school library. That was my homework, he says. Rogene Russell, who started driving Mason to Dallas Symphony Orchestra rehearsals after she'd met him at Career Day back in 2007, recalls that in 2014, she gave him a 20-volume set of The New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. Not long afterward, he reported that he'd read it cover to cover. Mason capped off his time at North Dallas High School by conducting one of his original works, Bulldog Fanfare, for the 2015 graduation ceremony. He went on to study at Dallas's Richland College for 2 years, then at Texas Christian University for a year. But he struggled to maintain interest in non-music classes, so he left TCU and transferred to Southern Methodist University, where he took music-specific classes as a non-degree student. He continued to write music the entire time, and in 2016, at age 20, he received his first commission for the University of Texas Arlington Saxophone Quartet. Unlike most of his peers, Mason, who has perfect pitch, didn't usually rely on an instrument in order to compose. If an idea for a score came to him while he was, say, shopping for groceries, he would later jot it down like a diary entry. entire pieces, said SMU composition teacher Lane Harder with astonishment, like he was taking dictation. Word of his talent was spreading, and the awards he was stacking up helped. So did Mason's eagerness to make connections. He emailed conductors and formed friendships and online chat groups. He worked every room he entered and composed pieces that players enjoyed performing, a predilection that shouldn't be underestimated. He met a bassoonist from Scandinavia and decided, okay, I'm going to write some bassoon etudes, said Russell's husband, Doug Howard, a former principal percussionist for the Dallas Symphony. And so he wrote a group of etudes for the bassoon, sends them to the guy, and the next thing we know, they're on YouTube. Like many young composers, Mason has spent much of his early years imitating the styles of others, a tradition he'd read about in all those library books he devoured as a child. He tried writing in the style of one composer, then another, examining the creator's predictable inclinations or magical departures. When he played a new score for Russell, she'd sometimes tease him. Quinn, have you been listening to Dvorak this week? Once, he even made a game of it. Mason brought a piano concerto to his Richland College composition teacher, Jordan Kuspa, and told Kuspa it had been written by an obscure Russian composer. But when Kuspa attempted to look up the composer, he couldn't find any reference to the musician. The work wasn't a masterpiece, Kuspa said, but it was strong. When Mason asked him what he thought of it, I gave him my opinion, Kuspa says, and I don't know for sure, but I came away with a very strong suspicion that he'd written a piano concerto in the Russian Romantic style and brought it to me just to see if I would be able to tell. That is true, Mason admits. In the years since, Mason has channeled the likes of Aaron Copland, John Adams, and of course Stravinsky. He's also played around with the genres of Latin music, like mariachi and banda, and studied singers such as salsa legend Hector Lavoe, whose work, he says, taught him how to think about the arc of a melody, how to write it, how to structure it, how to make it effective. He has produced electronic dance music tracks, club bangers, he says, and toyed with avant-garde styles well outside of the academy. When I first met him, he said he had just written a piece for 12 bass drums, said Greater Dallas Youth Orchestra music director Richard Aguingulo. Can you imagine 12 bass drums making music? But he was able to do that. The Dallas-based composer Robert Javier Rodriguez, who has mentored Mason, stresses that Mason has moved far past mere imitation. Rodriguez notes how the philosopher of science Sir Francis Bacon categorized some creators as ants, who simply rearrange the items they see around them, and some as bees, processing the pollen from different flowers to fashion a distinctive flavor of honey. Quinn is at that stage now, Rodriguez says. He's in those critical years in which he is developing his personal voice. That voice came through clearly when the Dallas Symphony Orchestra first commissioned Mason for a work entitled Inner City Rhapsody that premiered in September of last year. Mason had made prominent use of percussion and the contrabassoon, two sections that are often relegated to supporting roles. He experimented with triangles, using four of them, he says, to represent the spark of an idea at the beginning of the piece. From his time watching the DSO's rehearsals, Mason was familiar with its players, and he tailored the work to their strengths, writing expressive solos for the flute, oboe, and English horn. Quinn gives space for individual performers in his scores, says Orchestra Seattle's Will White. Even in his most active pieces, the music always has time to breathe. He doesn't write for musicians as though they're automatons whose sole purpose is to push the right button at the right time, according to his design. Stylistically, Mason often grafts little bits of modernism onto the rootstock of traditional tonality. It really reflects our time, says David Cooper, the principal horn player for the Chicago Symphony, who has commissioned a work from Mason. It reflects our architecture. It reflects the hustle and bustle sometimes of the digital age, but it still has reflection. It still has contemplation and beauty. Mason's new commission for the DSO, Reflection on a Memorial, will premiere to a reduced capacity pandemic audience this November. Harmonically and compositionally, it will be different from any other slow music I've written so far, he says. Harmonically, I've always stayed kind of safe, including in my recent works. Lately, however, I've been experimenting with different chordal structures and compositional architecture, and that has resulted in some interesting music. The theme of the evening's concert will be acknowledging racial injustice, and for this particular performance, Reflection will be dedicated to George Floyd, as well as other victims of racial violence. I've been thinking about the events that have been happening lately, he says, of the Black Lives Matter protest across the country, And I'm very glad that a new kind of movement is happening, that people are actually speaking up about the injustice that has been happening for years and years. I've personally experienced some of that myself, of course. But however autobiographical the work might be, and Mason says all his recent pieces are, he wants to leave his scores open to interpretation. I like to let my work speak for itself, he says. I want my music to reach as wide of an audience as possible and have a kind of lasting effect. Most of my colleagues don't think about this. Most of the pieces that are being written nowadays are one and dones. I personally do not like that because you spend all this time writing your piece, you planned it, you composed it, it took you a few months, and then you did all that hard work only for it to get played once and it's forgotten. This past April, Mason was commissioned to write a 3-minute piece for Orchestra Seattle called In Memory. After Grant Hanner, the principal violinist for the orchestra, premiered it online, Mason encouraged others to perform the composition without requesting the typical fees. Since then, in the middle of a pandemic, the work has been performed more than 40 times, and not just by violists. Oboists and a violinist have performed it too. Whether this means we're living in the age of Quinn Mason is too soon to say. To be honest, history is not up to us, says Richland College's Kuspa. Let's just say I'm optimistic that Mason's music will make an impact on the world. And that kind of conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. It's a little short, I apologize. We'll get to some more next week. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your print interview.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
West Texas Bull Invasion has been scheduled at 8 p.m. March 5th and at 10 p.m. March 6th at the Ector County Coliseum, 4201 North Andrews Highway. Call 214-718-1038.
Saturday and Sunday mornings, enjoy a variety of religious publications and features. Saturdays at 7 a.m., it's Guidepost Magazine, followed at 8 a.m. with the week's Sunday school lessons. Those are repeated Sundays beginning at 4 a.m. Then Sunday mornings at 6, it's Catholic Today. And at 7, Christianity Today. On Recording Library of West Texas Radio, read by listening.
forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 7 and snowing. Tonight, snowy with a low in the low single digits. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-teens. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a low in the upper single digits. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the website of Texas Highways, and our first one is titled, Can Chip and Joanna Gaines' New Magnolia Network Carry the Day? After watching a few shows on the new Discovery Plus streaming service, we find it a mix of emotions. Written by John Nova Lomax. After a year without Chip and Joanna Gaines, turned into two because of COVID-19, the Fixer Upper stars returned to the airwaves this week with the soft launch of their new Magnolia network. I say soft because it's rolling out in phases, and somewhat confusingly. For now, it's rolled into the launch of Discovery Inc.'s Discovery Plus. With more than a dozen networks and 55,000-plus episodes, the new streaming service offers a TV smorgasbord, ranging from BBC nature shows to Lifetime dramas to the new Waco-centric Magnolia Network, in what Discovery is calling, quote, the largest ever content offering of any new streaming service to date. New episodes of Fixer Upper won't be out until the end of the month, but I had the chance to check out a few episodes of Joanna's new cooking show, Magnolia Table, along with a bevy of Making of Magnolia Network shorts and episodes of two more Texas-based programs. The Field House is fixer-upper for people in need of a remodeling, body and soul. It's centered on an Abilene Gym athletic complex co-owned by former Baylor Bear football player Justin Bain, who says he's in the business of getting people back to being their best. In the first episode, we meet a young woman named Victoria with a history of eating disorders who wants to slim down for her wedding day and improve her mindset. Her story is intertwined with Bain's origin story. We learn about how football was a way out of poverty for him, how his dream was dashed with a broken femur, and how he clawed his way from working at Walmart to getting into the gym business. As with Waco and Fixer Upper, Abilene is given plenty of play via drone shots of its sun-baked downtown, waving fields of tall grass, and wind farms thrumming over the flatlands. There's more of a big city feel of self-employed, too self-employed, hosted by Fort Worth barbershop owner turned entrepreneur Jonathan Morris. This show is similar to Bar Rescue or Kitchen Nightmares, albeit with a flipped premise, where Morris seeks out successful entrepreneurs and has them show viewers how they've made it. In the premiere, he heads east from Panther City and into Big D to interview former City of Dallas civil engineer Val Jeanbart, a Haitian immigrant whose mother's final years and death saw him reborn with a new mission as the Cheesecake King of the Metroplex. It's a short episode, only 16 minutes, with a heart-tugging story and vivid footage of Jeanbart's colorful bakeries and drool-worthy confections. And so, on to Chip and Joanna. While I'd heard of them, I'd never seen a second of them in action. All I knew was something-something Waco, something-something Shiplap, whatever that is, so this was all terra incognita to me. The first thing I noticed was that the difference between the shows and the promotional making-of episodes was jarring. In some of the non-promotional programming, it's as if it's 2019 still. For instance, in Joanna's Magnolia Table, the pandemic seems inconceivable, alone as she is, aside from the film crew, in a quasi-rustic, characteristically open kitchen. It's a set, but I'm made to understand it's very much in her style. Whipping up Lebanese family feasts. There's fater, salad, hummus, and baklava one week, and Friendsgiving casserole-centered repast the next. Along the way, she dispenses hard-earned kitchen wisdom, such as, "There's a fine line between perfection and crap, and I'm trying to find that middle place." And, "If you don't have a good knife, you're working harder and not smarter." Those two Joanna-isms had me nodding along in agreement. Hers are complex menus in the Martha Stewart vein, as opposed to the one-pot jumbles of the harried working family. I could see her teaming up with Houston rapper Bun B, who makes 60-second YouTube shorts called Trill Meals with his young daughter. Like Martha and Snoop Dogg, Joanna Gaines and Bun B could have a kitchen throwdown, a Texan analog to potluck dinner party TV show. Back to Magnolia Table. As Joanna prepares her complex meals, she reminisces about her multicultural upbringing, Korean, Lebanese, and German, and talks about her kids' preferences. All while, old photos scroll past of meals and merry tables packed elbow to elbow with friends and family. There's no mention of the C word, nor mask in sight, even in a scene in which she drives over to her dad's place to deliver some leftover pater. Cut to the real world, as represented in the making of promotional shows, and the new normal is all too sadly apparent as the couple checks in on their talent via Zoom call after Zoom call. We see Bane, the ex-Baylor football player, desperately attempting to keep his gym compliant with pandemic safety regulations. Morris, the Fort Worth barbershop owner, recalls how he had to lay off his entire staff for a time before reopening with new safety procedures he says have changed the entire feel of his trade. "The energy is different now," he tells the couple. "A lot of the buzziness is gone, and it's more of a medical feeling now, a lot more sterile environment, but I'm excited to have people back at work and be able to provide for them again." At this point, we meet Erin French, owner of the restaurant The Lost Kitchen, which is also the name of her show. The restaurant is a chichi rustic country bistro in the staggeringly beautiful isolation of a place full of craggy mountains and tumbling waterfalls called Freedom, Maine. French tells Chip and Joanna that she's lost the entirety of her summer dining season because of the pandemic and is attempting to overhaul her whole business model in an effort to survive. Because local regulations cut her capacity at her already intimate restaurant, she decided it wasn't worth opening at all, at least not for dinner. "You want people to come into the space, and you want them to feel like they're in your home. And I can't do that right now if I'm covered in a mask," she says. "This is supposed to be a place to get away and relax and forget about it all. And so something about opening this space up doesn't feel right to me." And so some of her show will instead be about her contingency plans, building glamping cabins for diners to stay in post-pandemic, and establishing a curbside online farmer's market. Episode 1 is on the app now. I'll be honest, I'm not much for DIY home projects, nor of cooking the sort of elaborate meals Joanna enjoys, nor even fitness. But I did enjoy the footage of Texas and all the shows I sampled, from the town and country shots of Waco and Abilene, to the big city grit and glitz of Dallas and Fort Worth. And I could see becoming a fan of Self-Employed, as Morse is a likable host. As for the big picture, French's uncertain attitude pervades the launch of this network right now. In its new format, will Chip and Joanna be able to recapture the 17 million weekly viewers it had at its peak on HGTV? How many of the 120,000 monthly pilgrims will feel safe enough to return to the Magnolia Market silos in Waco, where they have a new furniture store, wiffle ball field, and, characteristically, restored